Hello, welcome to Stump, Death and Taxes. This is Meep, also known as Mary Pat Campbell, a life actuary. And today is not death nor taxes, but quid est veritas, that is, what is truth? Or looking at the continuing saga of Francesca Gino and some other people getting into trouble with their relationship with the truth, but actually, I'm going to mostly talk about myself. I love talking about myself. Now, just mainly talking about my difficulties with data and trying to get at the truth when I'm working with my numbers and trying to get information and getting truthful information. I'm deep in it in the day job, so I'm not talking about that, but also things with regards to the blog and why I'm not writing about some of the death data. I'm waiting for some issues to be ironed out. I'm not going to exactly talk about that directly. But quid est veritas, famously, well, that's from the Vulgate, Pontius Pilate saying what is truth, but he probably spoke Greek at the time, and from the Gospel of John, in answering Jesus when he was on trial, as it were. And veritas is the motto of Harvard University. Is that not ironic? Because we have some updates in the story of Francesca Gino, and here we go. This is from Science, which is a well-known name. This is the title of the piece, Embattled Harvard Honesty Professor Accused of Plagiarism. Academic chapter and two books authored by Francesca Gino appear to copy from sources including student theses, blogs, and news reports. So I'm just going to sample from this piece, which happens to be by Kathleen O'Grady. Harvard University honesty researcher Francesca Gino, whose work has come under fire for suspected data falsification, may also have plagiarized passages in some of her high-profile publications. A book chapter co-authored by Gino, who was found by a 2023 Harvard Business School HBS investigation to have committed research misconduct, contains numerous passages of text with striking similarities to 10 earlier sources. The sources include published papers and student theses. According to an analysis shared with Science by University of Montreal psychologist Aaron Ackland, Science has confirmed Ackland's findings and identified at least 15 additional passages of borrowed text in Gino's two books, Rebel Talent, Why It Pays to Break the Rules at Work and in Life, and Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. Some passages duplicate text from news reports or blogs. Others contain phrasing identical to passages from academic literature. The extent of duplication varies between passages, but all contain multiple identical phrases, as well as clear paraphrases and significant structural similarity. Now, that's the end of the particular, that's the end of the particular excerpt that I am reading. And at the end of the piece, and I'll put this on the show notes on the Substack, I'll do a little bit of a screenshot of just one of the examples. They have multiple examples, and I'll obviously do a link to the Science piece so that you can see what the pieces are themselves. And yeah, the examples are pretty clear copies of the original sources. Now, one of the items is, and I'll read this bit, this is a couple sentences, both of Gino's books in Gino and Ariely's chapter contain an extensive list of references. However, for most of the examples of apparent plagiarism detected by Science, the original text was not cited. Now, there can be multiple ways that this occurred, given the prominence of Gino and Ariely, who may have been involved with this too, for, well, at least one of the things, though the other pieces have Gino's name on them. Let's be frank. The high name, top name academic tends not to write everything that has their name on it. They get research assistants who do not get credit, or they might be in acknowledgments, who puts it together, and you kind of, quote, trust that everything is referenced properly. So that's one way plagiarism gets in these books, is that the people who actually wrote the book did the plagiarism. They didn't get the, they're not getting any, you know, authorship acknowledgement on the piece. And this has happened with other, quote, authors before in nonfiction. Sometimes it comes to light who the actual research assistants were, but usually they're not named because, you know, that would really, you know, uncover a lot of issues within academia. Do they really want that uncovered? Maybe or maybe not. From my point of view, the kinds of things that I'm trying to do, plagiarism per se is not my problem, except when someone plagiarizes from me. That does happen and has happened multiple times. And it's very funny to me when someone plagiarizes from the stuff I put online that's available for free, because I have a very strong writing voice. And, you know, and if you steal from my podcast, etc., I have a very strong voice to begin with. Obviously, with current AI, someone can take the original recordings and then turn it into somebody else's voice. Still, my word choice, my patterns, all of that kind of thing, it's me. It's hilarious. So many times since I've been online, writing online, since, you know, the 1990s, I have done searches for certain phrases, and I find myself, like, things that I wrote from the 1990s. This past weekend, on Sunday, I posted some items that I had written in 1994, so 30 years ago. And, you know, I'm not very happy with the result, but I've never edited it. And it still sounds like me. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I remember that. And the kinds of things I had to say about Sumo, and that was an isolated time. I got to see Sumo. I came back to the United States and I never got to see it again until recently, when I had streaming video and I could see it on NHK World. It sounds like me. I have a very strong personality. And when I write, I'm writing about things I'm interested in. When I'm writing for free, I should say, when I'm writing to be paid, I can submerge that personality, take a corporate tone, and do all sorts of things. I'm getting paid, after all. Why someone would take, for example, the very idiosyncratic paper I wrote on Niven and Purnell's Inferno, comparing it to Dante's Inferno, and try to pass it off as their own work, you've got to be nuts. That said, some professors and teachers are very lazy too, and so maybe you'll get away with it. And that's the case with these plagiarizing academics. I'm assuming they assume, because these are not, these papers and these books are not from like 20 years ago. They're only from a few years ago, 2018, 2016. Plagiarism detection software existed then. I know because I was teaching classes with Turnitin and those kind of things, and I was teaching writing classes, and I had to make my students put their papers in that software. And it was checking not only against other papers that were submitted through that software, but other things that are on the internet. So that science was able to find these academic papers to compare against Gino's published work that came from years before, or in some cases only 1 year before, it's not terribly surprising. So what this is, what plagiarism is from my point of view, it's not that it's false per se, it's deceptive, but it's not necessarily writing false things. From my point of view, things are problematic. It's stealing, but it's just falsifying whose words or whose ideas something was. But a lot of this is factual information, and it's still as factual as the original person who wrote it. Except In some of the cases of this plagiarism, the original words were taken and the conclusion has been changed or the context mangled. Not in Gino's case, but in other cases of plagiarism that have been found recently. I don't want to go down that particular rabbit hole. I want to go into some of these problematic, falsified scientific cases, and in some cases, spreadsheets are involved as well. So I'm jumping to a science that I really am not comfortable with. It's chemistry. Holes in the Holy Graphene story at Chemistry World by Valentin Rodionov. And this is a story, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I got good grades in chemistry, but when I got to place out of chemistry for college by getting a 5 on AP chemistry, I absolutely took that chance because I hated chemistry. It confused me. I wanted something simpler, which is why I majored in physics. Anyway, at one of the first meetings, I'm quoting the piece, of my brand new research group, a student was enthusiastically talking about a groundbreaking paper he had just read. A group of researchers had selectively broken down a 1,2,3 triazole, the product of one of the most important click reactions with ultrasound. Click chemistry was the subject of my PhD thesis, and our group used the method extensively. I was delighted with my student's choice of paper until I noticed something amiss. That infrared spectrum looked very wrong. A lively discussion ensued. The more I looked at the data, the less I believed the author's claims. And my student could not believe that I would dare question a paper published in Science. And that's the Science Journal, which I had just read the piece from on Francesca Gino. Okay, back to the original piece. We agreed that the data were inconsistent, but could not pinpoint the mistake. 4 years later, the paper was retracted following an institutional finding of research misconduct. So, and it went down going through another paper in the journal Matter, publishing a paper described a novel form of carbon. This purported allotrope, a holy graphene, is comprised mainly of, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, cyclooctadiene rings? I have no idea. Moreover, the synthesis was supposedly accomplished using a simple copper catalyst. Typically, the carbon-carbon bond forming single reactions of the kind claimed in the Matter paper require expensive palladium. The unusual structure and the unprecedented chemistry should have raised eyebrows during peer review, and ideally before this review commenced. 8-membered rings with even a single triple bond are highly reactive. Harnessing that reactivity has brought a Nobel Prize to Carolyn Bertozzi. A material containing that many 2 triple bond rings would be more energetic than TNT and likely quite prone to rapid unscheduled disassembly. Rapid unscheduled disassembly sounds like an explosion. I bet that's what that is. Contrary to these expectations, the paper asserted perfect stability of the holy material up to 700 degrees Celsius. While the reported spectroscopy was demonstrably mismatched with the claimed structure, the author simply declared that everything fits. And, if you go through this, there's no replication. They didn't share the data. They tried to replicate. So in trying to replicate the original experiment, it failed. They got that failed replication published, which is difficult to do. And the author of this piece is encouraging others to try to replicate other people's experiments and get, even if that replication fails, to get that published. So this is the conclusion. You may have come across equally troubling papers in your field. Don't remain silent. Share your concerns on platforms like PubPeer or social media. Reach out to journal editors and inform research compliance offices. This may end up being some of your most important work. So the problem, and this is not just social science, everyone has been treating this as if this is just an issue of the squishy sciences. This is a very hard science. You can see this is doing organic chemistry. Or maybe not organic, but definitely working with carbon, working with chemistry. This should be experiments that one can replicate. Humans are the most difficult part of this, as you can tell, and it always is. But the issue is, what are the motivations of the humans in this process? You want to get published in the most prestigious journals. And in this case, it was Science and Matter, perhaps. I don't know how, like, this is material science, I suppose, that these are prominent journals in their fields. How do they get published in these journals if the, you know, the material that they're publishing, that's questionable? Are they really getting reviewed? Do they have pull at these journals? These are not getting submitted blindly. They probably are prominent researchers involved. Maybe they're senior. Maybe they have a senior member that is what gives them an in to get published. Maybe there's some other things going on. There is politics, obviously, in academia, just not the politics one thinks in terms of Democrats and Republicans or Tories and Whigs or whatever your favorite politics are. So humans are involved. Anytime humans are involved, it can get quite tricky. It's not only money, it's status, it's all sorts of things are involved. But for other people who want to know the truth and whose own work may be dependent on these results and need to know what the real answers are. None of these sciences, obviously, are ones that I'm dependent on. Though in the case of Francesca Gino, one of the pieces that she and Dan Ariely worked on involved car insurance. Now, I don't work in auto insurance, but I do work in the insurance industry, and making recommendations of how insurers should do their applications for insurance, I was suckered, period. I wrote something about it and I was a fool. That is just the point. Now, I didn't make any important decisions on this, but I may have wasted some people's time in reading my article. And I'm like, oh, you know, I didn't know what I was talking about, period. And somebody faked the data. Now I know. I've been focusing on publicly available situations, and they're not necessarily all fraud, but it can be sloppy work. It can be people who are simply incompetent or just they don't know what they're doing. I'm getting a lot of this from retractionwatch.com, which is my favorite place for finding these scientific studies that, again, some are fraudulent, some are plagiarized. Some are just, I'm sorry, this one, I'm looking at it, I'm like, I think it's just dumb. Some of these that I have seen, and I get this with some actuarial type, I've seen a lot of this through COVID, by the way, of people who don't understand mortality data or life expectancy and that sort of thing. So let me explain this one. The first piece, this is from the 5th of February, 2024, is titled No Data, No Problem, Undisclosed Tinkering in Excel Behind Economics Paper. Here it goes. Last year, a new study on green innovations and patents in 27 countries left one reader slack-jawed. The findings were no surprise. What was baffling was how the authors, two professors of economics in Europe, had pulled off the research in the first place. The reader, a PhD student in economics, was working with the same data described in the paper. He knew they were riddled with holes, sometimes big ones. For several countries, observations for some of the variables the study tracked were completely absent. The authors made no mention of how they dealt with this problem. On the contrary, they wrote they had balanced panel data, which in economic parlance means a data set with no gaps. I was dumbstruck for a week, said the student, who requested anonymity for fear of harming his career. His identity is known to Retraction Watch. The student wrote a polite email to the paper's first author, Almas Heshmati, a professor of economics at Jönköping University in Sweden, asking how he dealt with the missing data. An email correspondence seen by Retraction Watch and a follow-up Zoom call, Heshmati told the student he had used Excel's autofill function to mend the data. He had marked anywhere from 2 to 4 observations before or after the missing values and dragged the selected cells down or up, depending on the case. The program then filled in the blanks. If the new numbers turned negative, Heshmati replaced them with the last positive value Excel had spit out. Okay, I'm not going to even go into this. So what this is called is there's something called imputation when you have these kind of holes. So what often happens in real life, you're trying to do a statistical model that you're trying to fit, but you don't have data for all of, say, maybe all of the years, all of the dimensions that you're looking at, that sort of thing. But a lot of the modeling approaches requires you to have data points for every single dimension, every single year, that kind of thing. So when you have this kind of holy data, you have to make decisions. One decision is to throw away that, you know, those data for, like, say, that country or whatever. But then you end up essentially with no data, or you end up with just the United States and the United Kingdom, or, you know, something like that, which is not really a great solution if you're trying to compare between multiple countries. So you do something called imputation, and there's so many different ways to do imputation. So imputation is a way to come up with values for those missing cells. And there's a lot of legitimate ways to come up with values for those cells. You can do a bootstrap sample, you can do some random samples, you can take the average of all the others, you can do some different kinds of statistical sampling to come up with what looks like something that doesn't bias the modeling result that will come out at the end of your work. But if you do imputation, number one, you need to say that some of your data are imputed, and then you need to say what imputation method you used. In no legitimate academic approach is Excel's autofill a legitimate imputation approach, because if you have ever used Microsoft Excel autofill, even when you know you have a very obvious pattern in front of you and you try to pull down and get an autofill in there, it is one of the worst pattern recognizers out there. It will put complete trash in the cells. Usually it will do a constant pattern or a linear pattern or like A, B, A, B, A, B. It does not do a great, it's not a great imputation method, and that is way understating the case. That is so funny to find out that this guy, that this PhD student was able to get Heshmati to just stay, oh yeah, I just use Excel autofill, but they didn't, means that Heshmati didn't realize how stupid that was, number one, that it was completely stupid, number two, that he didn't document it in the paper at all, he didn't disclose it. This guy doesn't know how to handle data. So let me get back to it. So it got worse. So I'm back to the post. Heshmati's data, which the student convinced him to share, showed that in several instances where there were no observations to use for the autofill operation. So now this is worse. So like you don't even have something to do autofill on. The professor had taken the values from an adjacent country in the spreadsheet. New Zealand's data had been copied from the Netherlands, for example, and the US's data, United States data, from the United Kingdom. So some of the United States data were missing, and so they were copying over from countries that had certain patterns. This way, Heshmati had filled in thousands of empty cells in the data set, well over 1 in 10, including missing values for the study's outcome variables. A table listing descriptive statistics for the study's 25 variables referred to 783 observations of each variable, but did not mention that many of these observations were in fact imputations. This fellow, he imputed everything, the student said. He is a professor. He should know that if you do so much imputation, then your data will be entirely fabricated. And pretty much statistically, nothing that came out of this was valid. I'm going to go back to an example I have in my past, and that was when I was a freshman in college. And it was a math modeling seminar, something. It was kind of extra, not really on an official curriculum. I think we got credits for it. But what we really did during the semester was take something from a UN committee, subcommittee for CITES, which was Endangered Species Treaty that was in place at the time. And a group of Japanese and Cuban scientists had put together a paper that was to make the case that they should be allowed to fish sea turtles again for all the lovely things that the Japanese and Cubans wanted to use sea turtles for. And I don't remember which sea turtle species it was. Doesn't matter. There was data, supposedly, in the appendix, and we were supposed to look at the math model. It was a population model for the sea turtles that supposedly would mean the sea turtle population would grow, even under these farming conditions, under various parameters. And there was some supposed data in the appendix, and I looked at it, and they were saying this was data of current population, but I realized it was modeled. It was all made up. None of it was actual data. It was all imputed, in other words, as it were. It was all fabricated. They were using their own made up stuff to say, hey, we proved our other made up stuff. Our professor, you know, we were concerned about the critique we were doing of their model. And we were trying to find the weaknesses in their model and this, that, and the other. And I was writing stuff down. And we were very concerned. It was so obvious. So much of it was bogus. And we were writing things up. And this was an endangered species. The professor said, don't worry. Nothing is dependent on the math or your criticism anyway. It's all going to be determined politically. But imagine if... This study, so many bogus studies like that, really bogus, and I'm sure you heard the unspoken word in there, I'm from New York, of supposed damage done by plastic straws, and a whole bunch of disabled people where plastic straws makes their life easier, now have to deal with a whole bunch of nonsense because of a bogus science project by a little kid based on a whole bunch of bogosity. So we get this kind of crap. That's why truth matters. If it was actually true, then yeah, that would be something. But if it's not true at all in the first place, well, you know, that's kind of something, because what happened later in the month of February, Retraction Watch had an exclusive Elsevier to retract paper by economists who failed to disclose data tinkering, a paper on green innovation that drew sharp rebuke for using questionable and undisclosed methods to replace missing data will be retracted, its publisher told Retraction Watch. Previous work by one of the authors, a professor of economics in Sweden, is also facing scrutiny, according to another publisher. As we reported earlier this month, Almaz Heshmati of Jönköping, I'm sorry, I know I'm mispronouncing it, university, mended a dataset full of gaps by liberally applying Excel's autofill function and copying data between countries. Operations other experts described as horrendous and beyond concern. So, moving to a different piece by a different person. This is from February 21st, 2024, also at Retraction Watch, How Not to Deal with Missing Data, an economist's take on a controversial study. So, nearly 100 years ago, Muriel Bristol refused to drink a cup of tea that had been prepared by her colleague, the great British statistician Ronald Fisher, because Fisher had poured milk into the cup first and tea second, rather than tea first and milk second. Fisher didn't believe she could tell the difference, so he tested her with 8 cups of tea, half milk first and half tea first. When she got all 8 correct, Fisher calculated the probability a random guesser would do as well, which works out to be 1.4%. He soon recognized that the results of agricultural experiments could be gauged in the same way, by the probability that random variation would generate the observed outcomes. If this probability, the p-value, is sufficiently low, the results might be deemed statistically significant. How low? Fisher recommended we use a 5% cutoff and ignore entirely all results which fail to reach this level. His 5% solution soon became the norm. Not wanting their hard work to be ignored entirely, many researchers strive mightily to get their p-values below 0.05. For example, a student in my introductory statistics class once surveyed 54 classmates and was disappointed that the p-value was 0.114. This student's creative solution was to multiply the original data by 3 by assuming each survey response had been given by 3 people instead of 1. I assumed I originally picked a perfect random sample, and that if I were to poll 3 times as many people, my data would be greater in magnitude but still distributed in the same way. This ingenious solution reduced the p-value to 0.011, well below Fisher's magic threshold. Ingenious, yes. Sensible, no. If this procedure were legitimate, every researcher would multiply their data by whatever number is necessary to get a p-value below 0.05. The only valid way to get more data is, well, to get more data. This student should have surveyed more people instead of fabricating data. So this piece was in response to what Heshmati had done in using Excel's autofill. This author noted that instead of only a few missing variables being values being filled in the data set, nearly 2,000 observations for the 19 variables that are in the paper were being imputed. So 13% of the data set was using imputed values when it was getting fit. Then using the adjacent values, 2, 3, or 4 adjacent values, and it was just tinkering around. There was no standard approach that he used. And changing the number of adjacent values he used for autofill had a large effect on the estimates of the missing values. And I could tell anybody who's used autofill on Excel knows that to be the case. The authors also found that Excel's autofill function sometimes generated negative values, which they couldn't have for their data. So for example, Korea is missing R&D investment. So green R&D investments data for 1990 to 1998. So the authors used Excel's autofill for 3 years with only 3 years of data, 1999, 2000, and 2001, to create data for 9 missing years. The imputed values were negative, so the authors just set them equal to the positive 1997 value. Just arbitrarily. Overall, let me read this and then I'll explain. Overall, the missing observations in this data set are not evenly distributed across countries and years. IPR Pro, an index of intellectual and property rights strength, is missing 79% of its data because there are only observations every 4, 5, or 6 years. Another variable, EDU-TER, government expenditures on tertiary education as a percentage of GDP, was said to be a crucial determinant of innovativeness, but is missing 34% of its data. So one of the pieces of data comes with a certain frequency. Other data can be missing for various reasons because the government's decided to measure it in particular years for particular reasons. This is something to think about because a lot of times these variables are being measured by the governments that you're trying to evaluate. That's something to think about. This is an issue with a lot of real life data. A lot of us who want to try to do anything with data with regards to China have to figure out, oh, is this something that's coming from the communist Chinese government itself? Well, if it is coming from the Chinese Communist Party itself, like GDP growth data, we might not believe it. That's something we need to think about. But if there's some other outside parties that are using some other proxies in terms of exports and other independently measured variables, we might believe it a little more. And so this gets back to my core problem that of a lot of the stuff that I work on is I'm dependent on other people's produced data. And it's not passive data. It has to be generated. It has to be measured in some way. And I have noticed, I have checks and I look at how this data changes and I have different ways of seeing that things add up to what they're supposed to be. A lot of other people who have worked with a variety of these data sets are not necessarily that careful. And when they see changes, may think something real has happened as opposed to what has happened in many cases, that something has happened with the data quality for a variety of reasons. And you know, it's not all nefarious. Sometimes something operationally has occurred. So recently, I'll give a very innocuous one. I have a Substack, SumoStats, and one of the big reference sites, because it's relatively easy to use for those of us interested in sumo statistics. It's run out of Germany, a sumo reference site, and it goes down every so often because it cannot take a lot of traffic. And it, with the death of Aki Bono, who was very prominent, the first foreign-born Yokozuna, well, it went down for over a day. And a lot of those of us, I managed to get in and grab some Aki Bono statistics before it really crashed. But it's back up. Someone else who has a rival statistics site, well, it is not so user-friendly, but because I'm a little more technically inclined, I might start using that one instead because it's not as popular to use. And I might be able to set up some code to do a feed and do some other stuff. So I'm looking forward to trying that. But I also have multiple sites now that I can check against each other, which is something I will like because I have noticed there's certain statistics that have to be basically manually checked. And there's some data like Midori Fuji's height that nobody believes. But we have to get into the kind of Midori Fuji holding a phone vertically and then trying to figure out his height that way kind of detective skills, given that a bunch of us think he's lying about his height. Anyway, that's not that important. Not like some of these other things. So this last piece was by Gary Smith, an economics professor at Pomona College. He ended with, "There is no justification for a paper not stating that some data were imputed and describing how the imputation was done. It is even worse to state the data had no missing observations. This paper might have been assessed quite differently, perhaps not published at all, if the reviewers had known about the many imputations and how they were done." So Gary Smith, it says his one of his books that he wrote was Standard Deviations, Flawed Assumptions, Tortured Data, and Other Ways to Lie with Statistics. And that was one of, not his book per se, but one of the things I like to teach when I taught statistics. And actually, I mainly taught it to graduate students in math who were about to teach the intro probability and statistics class because most of them had never taken statistics or probability, but knew it was going to be easy for them to teach it to themselves from the undergrad textbook and then teach it to the students. I'm sorry. The theory is very easy to learn, But what they didn't know were the practical aspects. So I came in with all of the practical from real life examples, and I needed to tell them some of the ways that statistics had actually been tortured in real life and different examples they could actually just, you know, get from a New York Times article or Wall Street Journal or whatever and point out to them how should they be thinking about these numbers they're seeing every day in the news around them with regards to average and median and what kinds of things they should be thinking about when they see these things. So we are given numbers all the time. Today, as I record this, is tax day in the US. And we're often told about tax rates, but is it the average tax rate over all of the income earned, or is it an adjusted gross income, or is it the marginal tax rate on that last dollar earned? Because you can have a marginal tax rate that's over 100%. I know that's happened before. It's idiotic when it does happen, but it does happen. For those who want to do wealth taxes on unearned, unrealized capital gains. So this is just stuff on paper that may never have been realized. And then, of course, will they do it when it goes negative? Of course not. They only want to ratchet it one way. We have a bunch of non-numerate politicians who don't know where all the numbers are and cannot think statistically, cannot think probabilistically, definitely cannot even think arithmetically in many cases. So that's pleasant. They wouldn't understand why this high-tech approach of using Excel autofill would not work and why that's not statistically valid. Why can't you do it that way? It's on a computer. Quid est veritas anyway? And so after I've gone through chemistry and economics, fraud and just goofiness and just invalid statistics, now I'm going to get you really depressed and research fraud with regards to cancer. We're not curing cancer here, guys, from the Free Press. This was February 22nd, 2024. This is by Oliver Wiseman and Vinay Prasad. A top cancer surgeon at Columbia University is under scrutiny after one of his research papers was retracted for containing suspect data. 26 other studies by Dr. Sam S. Yoon, who conducted his research at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, have been flagged as suspicious by a British scientific sleuth called Sholto David. David raised the alarm after spotting the same images across different articles that described wholly different experiments. He has also found duplications and manipulated data in papers published by researchers at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston that have since been retracted. This news shocked me. Leading scientists at some of the most respected research centers in the world working on very important and well-funded fight against cancer are making stuff up. That seems really bad, really bad. And it poses a lot of unsettling questions, like whether we can really trust medical research at all. But maybe I'm missing something. In search of reassurance, I called up an expert, oncologist, UCSF professor, the author of more than 500 academic papers, and Free Press contributor, Vinay Prasad. And so they did a Q&A. Vinay Prasad said, a few years ago, there was a proposal by the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors arguing that every paper published in the top journals should make the raw data available. That proposal was shot down because people were worried about their careers and that other researchers would take their data and use it to make breakthroughs before them. Sharing is the solution. You should have to make all the data available whenever you publish medical research. My comment over at Go Actuary was it shouldn't just be a situation with regards to medical research. This was in response to indications of the data fraud in cancer research. And those papers are getting retracted. Let's be serious. This is not about those squishy studies papers. Nobody really cares about them, and everyone knows they're nonsense. But if you find out that the data in cancer research is being faked, so they keep saying, oh, somebody else may find a, you know, make a breakthrough before I do. So maybe they can make it a standard. One has to credit the data originators on the papers, but they will know it's just the data, not my analysis. Well, that's true. Maybe the data originators get the right of first publication or something in a certain amount of time. You know, you can figure something out. In the case of my Substack, I always put my spreadsheets up if I remember. Like, if I forget and you want the spreadsheet, I always keep copies, of course. Most of the time, I'm publishing the spreadsheet in case I forget where I put it. In case I forgot where I put the data. And I'm working on multiple copies. If you ever look at the names of the spreadsheets, I try to always put the date in the name of the file. I also have a tab called Documentation Information that has additional information of like data sources and other notes that I leave primarily for myself and not for people. It's mainly writing for myself to leave breadcrumbs in case I lose earlier files. So I'm actually writing all of this stuff for me. But if other people want to download this stuff and look at it and do things with them, they are very welcome to, because it's all public data. I don't work with anything private. So, you know, this is a problem in the sciences. A lot of the people are going for a brass ring in terms of tenure. And even once they have tenure, they are trying to go for grants. They're trying to go for more senior positions. They're trying to get the best locations on campus and the best lab space and this, that, and the other. It's status, status, status. And there's a lot of constraint in what they can do. And you get kind of stuck in the corporate world. I mean, and also, you know, I do side things and I can do a lot of other things in growing and, you know, working on projects and this, that, and the other, and not worry, have to worry about it. And one of the issues with publications, how slow it is compared to just getting stuff out there, though, obviously that has improved somewhat. But I saw all sorts of dysfunctions with regards to the applied math modeling of people developing models. Nobody was going to steal my models, crying out loud. They don't want to play with anybody else's models. They want to play with their own models. There wasn't a lot of optimization of anything with regards to what I was seeing, and not necessarily a lot of growth in many ways. Anyway, I like doing what I do, but I do need to have real data to build it on. Whether it's SUMO or mortality trends or public pension systems and their finances, I do depend on other people to have those data sets for me. I don't have the time to build those sets up. So I thank everybody, whether they're in the government or in a nonprofit organization or a fan group that are following SUMO. So, you know, I'm very happy that these people have been putting these nice data sets together for me. But, you know, in some of these, it's very sad to me that in the old academic stomping grounds, that a lot of these places are shot through with fraud and plagiarism. That's not why I left. I didn't think it was that bad, but obviously it's gone in that direction. So anyway, I hope next time I can do something happier. Next week, in 1 week from today, it's going to be a birthday for me. So maybe I can do something happy next week. But that's been Stump, Death and Taxes. Talk to y'all another time. Bye-bye.